Back at it, you and I together on Connecticut Today, Monday, November 23rd, 2020. We kick off Thanksgiving week. We spoke to Dr. Michael Urban from the University of New Haven about occupational health outcomes as folks recover from COVID-19. And speaking of the coronavirus, we got the latest from Governor Ned Lamont. I also kicked off the show with my thoughts at the current point regarding efforts some Republicans are making to try and overturn the election. It makes no sense. A lot of you are going to call and jump up my backside about this, but this has been just churning in me all weekend, and I have to say it. Listen, you've got everybody and their uncle in both sides now in Washington, including a lot of Republicans and a lot of well-intentioned people saying that, you know, it's time. And I'm sorry, I know you're going to get up, you're going to get all crazy with this, and it doesn't mean the investigations can continue, but it is time to release the money, the transition money that the Biden team needs, and it's time to allow the transition process to move forward. Okay, now we are 20 days, we're coming up on 3 weeks after the election, and we're promised all of these bombshell revelations from all the Trump lawyers, and we got nothing. We, in fact, at last look, I saw a figure at last look, the Trump team has won 2 out of 30 or 32 lawsuits. Now, before you go crazy, let's go back, because now I'm being vindicated on this. Okay, and I did a ton of reading on this and listening over the weekend. I've been pouring through stuff on this since I got up at like 6 a.m. this morning. I couldn't sleep. Even the Trump White House is starting to understand that this Sidney Powell lawyer, whoever the hell she is, and I know she's got a long resume and she does some good corporate work, I got that, but this is why, I don't know whether you saw this last night, they're starting to distance themselves from her. Now, they still have some things they want to check into, and I have said from the very beginning on this whole thing, that if you have some documentable funny business with these mail-in ballots, then go ahead and look at it. Take a look at it. One of the two victories I think the Trump lawyers have had, one judge agreed, yeah, you probably should not have counted some ballots in Pennsylvania after 8 o'clock on election night. All right. And I think they said that the Secretary of State there was not under the authority to extend the ballot, however that went. Okay, I can see that. But on the vast majority of the other lawsuits, they're not getting any wins here. Now, you just heard top of the hour news there. There are some Republicans saying, hey, there may have been some funny business. Re-canvass Michigan. Okay, you want to re-canvass Michigan? Do a recount. That's fine. That's fine. You can go ahead and do that. That's okay. You can count Georgia as many times as you want. You can count Pennsylvania as many times as you want. That's fine. Do that. There are, you know, there are either statewide laws. Usually it's at 0.5% or lower if the ending ending gap is, you know, within a certain window in an individual state. You get an automatic recount. If not, you got to pay for it. Okay, well, I guess that's being done. But this thing that Sidney Powell keeps saying she has, she's got evidence of this computer system that was flipping votes, and it was channeled through Germany and Venezuela, and here's the worst thing now. And folks, I told you this a week ago and 2 weeks ago. Now she's dragging in Brian Kemp, the governor of, ding, 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 Georgia. She's dragging him into it. She's dragging Kelly Loeffler in it. Again, Georgia. There are two runoffs coming up in Georgia. And she's just, this is why now this afternoon, even more people, in fact, Donald Trump Jr. just said, I thought I had this pulled up. Donald Trump Jr. essentially, In a tweet, I'll have it for you after the break, Donald Trump Jr. said, forget talk of all this riffraff in Georgia. Get out and vote. The Trump team is finally starting to realize what I was talking about, not last week because I wasn't here, but the week before. You better be real careful about alleging funny business in the election when you have no evidence that could overturn a national election. Yeah, was there some funny business with some mail-in votes? Probably, yeah. But you're talking about millions or hundreds of thousands of votes. There's no evidence of that. And this Sidney Powell keeps popping up on Newsmax and on Fox and on these stuff. Well, wait, I have the evidence. Well, geez, what are you doing then? Do you have the evidence or do you not have the evidence? So, you know, again, as soon as we take the break, I'll come up exactly what Donald Trump Jr. said. But this stuff is, now we're really into territory. You know, look, like I said 2 or 3 weeks ago, what the Trump camp is doing, they know they lost. They know they lost. But what they want to do is come up with a couple of 2 or 3 or 4 minor court victories here to just say, hey, you know, this mail-in voting, this is not really all it's cracked up to be. This stuff is vulnerable to funny business, which I agree with. But the fact that you have this other one now that they've kind of distanced themselves from saying, you know, well, we've got evidence that these votes were flipped. And it came out over the weekend that her and Rudy Giuliani, what's happened to Rudy? With the hair dye, Rudy, come on. Gray hair is okay, Rudy. What's he going to Just for Men all of a sudden? Like, we don't know, Rudy. Come on. It came out over the weekend that what they thought were Michigan votes were really Minnesota votes, and somebody thought MI meant Minnesota when actually the two-digit abbreviation or the two-character abbreviation for Minnesota is MN, not MI. It's just... Now, does she have gangbuster evidence? Maybe she does. But release the hounds, sister. Let's go. If you got anything, let's see it. If not... get out of the way. And I love these people say, well, you know, it's strategic. She's trying to play chess when everybody's playing checkers. Please, please stop that. Please. Traffic and weather together. What do you think? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. 216. Back at it Monday, Connecticut Today. All right, 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted earlier today. He sent out this tweet at just before 10 a.m. this morning. I'm seeing a lot of talk from people that are supposed to be on our side telling GOP voters not to go out and vote for Kelly Loeffler or a David Perdue. That is nonsense. Ignore these people. We need all of our people coming out to vote for Kelly and David. There you go. So I think the Trump household knows what's going on here. So. Folks, I'm telling you, I know a lot of you folks aren't going to be happy me saying this, but this is all this stuff about this computer program and the votes are changed and it ran through Venezuela and there were servers in Germany and the military got a hold of this. All this is doing is handing the Democrats the Senate. Trust me on this. In the Stanford Advocate, among the newspapers that it ran in, don't give the gift of COVID this holiday season. No, don't do that. And it was written by our next guest who joins us right here on WICC. He's a senior lecturer and director of the Doctorate of Occupational Therapy Program at Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Michael Urban joins us. Dr. Urban, Paul here at WICC. How are you today?
Good. I'm doing good. Thank you for having me on.
And thanks for taking the time, Dr. Urban. We appreciate it. As an occupational therapist, and I read your piece with interest here. You don't hear, at least I haven't heard from many occupational therapists in a prominent place in a lot of the news coverage of this. So you bring an interesting point of view to the whole COVID situation. What was the message of that op-ed that that was posted in the Stanford Advocate? And from your position in the occupational therapy field, what do you think about this whole thing?
Yeah, so, you know, the op-ed piece I wrote was really looking at how we're handling the whole management. You know, it's a modern pandemic, and are we really utilizing our best practices coming forward? So as we think about how we deliver care in our system, whether it's from emergency medicine to, on my end, the aftercare, the rehabilitative side, we can really think about, you know, what's the best practice and the evidence that shows us are we delivering care the most effectively. And we hear a lot of runaround from, you know, our leaders didn't do this or people didn't do that, but really utilizing our systems from the best mindset going forward. So from an occupational therapist standpoint and someone who works as a Lean Six Sigma black belt, looking at making improvements in healthcare policy, healthcare leadership avenues, we think about really what is the best practice and approach and utilizing our best resources. And, you know, we're starting to do that more and more now, but for the longest point, we haven't done that from a standpoint, which has led to our hospitals being inundated, our supplies running low, and really not able to manage the, you know, the influx to try to minimize the need from an occupational therapy standpoint, us having to provide the aftercare. If we
Is it tough because we haven't really in our lives, Dr. Urban, we haven't seen this, I mean, really, since, or the country hasn't, since the flu pandemic of 1918 to 1920. I mean, I don't know, did we or did we not have any sort of a reference point on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, you could look at how we handled it back then, but, you know, we've seen other outbreaks that we participated in globally. We've seen, you know, between the AIDS epidemics to other, you know, impacts healthcare across the world. We've seen swine flu going around. So we can look at other stuff that's gone on. We are a global healthcare system, as much as we want to, some people may not want to say that. We had to look at globally how we communicate and how we work to track and monitor outbreaks. So from a rehabilitative side on my side, you know, I'm constantly looking to see what's being done in other parts of the world to make sure we're utilizing the best care here and innovations, because we are, as a country, the United States is the forefront of innovation. But we have to make sure we're using it most effectively and making sure that innovation is filling the crucial gaps to make sure the care is being delivered correctly and targeting those areas that are needed. So we could have learned from our best practices and looked at how things are being done. But again, we didn't benchmark our current response plan. You know, if you thought about it from a bioterrorism attack versus a, you know, looking at it from a just a general how you do infection control in a hospital, yeah, but now on a larger scale, that's what we could have been looking more towards.
Dr. Michael Urban is the guest from Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Urban, standby. We'll be right back with you after traffic and weather together right here, 3:36 on WICC. And let me open this segment here by making a needed correction. Our guest who's joining us for the next few minutes, Dr. Michael Urban, is director of the Doctorate of Occupational Therapy Program at the University of New Haven, not Southern, even though they're relatively close to each other. Want to straighten that out. So, Dr. Urban, I know you're, what, like a 30th degree black belt. I don't want to get you upset or anything. So.
That's okay.
From the University of New Haven, high on the hill there in West Haven. You talk about aftercare. And frankly, I don't think I've heard a lot about that. We hear about, you know, the triaging, the ICU stuff, people getting admitted, how long they're in intensive care. But what are your thoughts? Talk to my listeners a little, Dr. Urban, about the whole aftercare aspect of this as far as COVID is concerned.
Yeah, so I mean, the aftercare, you know, and talking, you know, looking at my colleagues who are actively in the field working, you know, across the nation and even overseas, you're looking at, you know, if you have a severe case, if you get, you know, people who say, oh, it's a small flu, COVID, I can 2 weeks from sick, I'm out. You're seeing people who are being intubated, you know, ventilated near in a coma state, who may be bedridden for a long period of time. We're having reports of people having cognitive impairments. So from an occupational therapy standpoint, you know, people are having, you know, fatigue, chronic fatigue, muscle pain, and these mental fluctuations that, you know, we have to address these people to help them to engage in their everyday living. So people don't realize, I think, those long-term effects. And we are certainly learning more and more as this prolongs. We won't know some of the chronic conditions that could come from this potentially for maybe another year or two or even longer, you know, as you see with some other diseases that have happened in the past, as you know, you see lifelong effects, or they could be short-term, which I'm hoping for those that were impacted.
So are we seeing then, Doctor, more of, say, long-term cardiopulmonary issues, simple breathing? Do people who have severe cases of COVID, do they simply have to, you know, as we used to say, get their wind back? Of course, that's simplifying it. But, mm-hmm. you know, is just breathing and being able to move around and not get winded, is that a problem for some of these patients?
Yeah, so a lot of patients, yeah, for some of those patients, it is just that simple, you know, easy that chronic fatigue almost appearance, trying to build their endurance back up if they were severely wiped out. It really depends on the severity of how much they were impacted. And again, something that you take for granted every day, you know, just being able, you know, put your pants on, walking into the bathroom, getting into the shower. If you're really short of breath, if you're fatigued, if your body is trying to recover from this, your balance could be impacted, a high risk of fall. Cardiovascular-wise, you may have the output to endure what you need to do for a whole day, let alone go back to work, care for your kids, care for your family. And so as you look at really what people, you know, may say, oh, I'm a COVID fatigue. I'm sick of these restrictions of having to wear a mask where, you know, that risk of this virus going on and on not only can mean you get a worse case of it, depends on your immune system, but those long-term effects, you know, how long you'll be in that situation, you know, you could be looking, you know, sometimes people get hospitalized for like, you know, 3 or 4 days and they're in recovery for weeks or months. Because again, it doesn't take much for your body to really get wiped out sometimes from a very, complicated or involving condition.
And as you say, doing simple things, as you said, getting dressed, going to the bathroom, walking throughout your house, that's one thing. But correct me if I'm wrong, doctor, the other level here is even just existing. Your body needs a certain level, you know, an oxygen saturation easily mm-hmm. gained by breathing to just have your organs and your internal system functioning. And that, I would imagine, is strained as well.
Yes, and this virus is doing that. That's why people are being put on ventilators. So again, you know, people think, oh, I can just lug around an oxygen tank. But trust me, having worked with patients, young and old, you don't want to be on supplemental oxygen if you don't need to be. But again, that may be a nature of recovery, helping. And that's as an occupational therapist, we'd be working with you to, along with our other allied health professionals, to help recover and build your endurance up with your everyday tasks to get you hopefully off the oxygen. If your lungs and your heart and your body build that endurance back up to that level where you can be safely off and maintain a saturation level that will allow you to engage in your everyday functioning on a day-to-day basis.
What are we better at now, Dr. Urban, you know, 8, 9, 10 months into this than we were, say, a month or two into this, particularly from your field of study? What have we learned? You know, what kind of aha moments did we have here that maybe make what you do and the folks in your end of it do a little easier?
Yeah, so a lot of what makes my job easier is really what's done up at the forefront. So you think about how quickly we can get someone in, get the treatment they need to minimize that prolonged. So you know, someone who stays at home and tries to, you know, sweat it out at home, and lets the virus, you know, go untreated or unrecognized, and their oxygen saturation maybe drop below for long periods of time, could do more harm to you. So again, people who neglect to go get the medical attention right away sometimes can make their conditions even worse and make those debilitating effects even last longer. So that can make our jobs not necessarily harder, but just take longer that we have to spend with you to get you back to recovery and hopefully back to your baseline, if not to your new, what we would call your new baseline, if you can't recover. So we may have to recommend a certain piece of equipment that you may have to go out and buy and retrofit your bathroom to make it safe again or make your home safer just to get around and do what you have to do. So I think really what we're doing better, those aha moments, is really at the forefront is just basically everyone wearing a mask and hoping for things, like I was trying to raise awareness for Thanksgiving, at least stay home, don't do the big family dinners, don't travel. But we've already seen tons of people traveling already for the holiday season at the airports already. And yeah. Trying to really, if you're feeling sick or you think you may have been exposed, stay home, quarantine for 2 weeks. And quarantine isn't, I'm going to go out and just see my family. Quarantine is staying home and not going out unless you absolutely have to go out.
Yeah.
Those aha moments really can reduce what the, can allow the doctors in the emergency rooms do what they're doing to help the people that are more critically care and not strap our services. And that, when we talk about flattening the curve, we flattened the curve back in the spring. The thing I question is, did we really flatten it or did we just slow it to the point where, from a medical standpoint, we wouldn't, you know, remove your oxygen if you were still dropping below 90% saturation every time you were moving around. We wouldn't say, oh, you're cured, it's good enough. We would keep you on it until you absolutely were there. So I think some of the reopenings that we did to stimulate the economy was sort of ill-fated to allow this to kick back up again, because again, you know, the doctors were saying, we're still not there yet, don't push it.
Yeah.
Our experts were saying the same thing, but we pushed, you know, we allowed money to speak over logic with healthcare. And that's sort of those aha moments that we need to really just do our civic duty and rein that in a little bit more.
The point you brought up in the op-ed, listen, we all love our families. We all love the holidays. Thanksgiving is my favorite time of the year. It's the only time of the year I see everybody on my father's side of the family. You know, a lot of families feel that way, but, you know, I'll skip the dinner if people won't get killed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I find that, Dr. Urban, maybe I'm just looking at it from a dumb talk show host point of view here, but to me, it's kind of a no-brainer. I love flying. I love going over the country, but you know what? I'll skip it this year. That's just me.
And that's just it. It's not, you know, you hit it right on the nail on the head. You know, if you think about it, we make a small sacrifice, then maybe come Christmas, maybe for the new year, you can get together again with more people. I mean, it's only a few weeks away, but if we can really hone it down and crack it down, you've seen other countries do it where they, not saying complete lockdown, but just sort of really just taking that due diligence of really taking quarantining seriously, taking the mask wearing, washing their hands, and caring for everyone, not only just your family, but your neighbors, the people in your community, treating everyone as the same. And we really seem to see that virus die down in those countries for the most part, as long as we don't rush it back out.
Dr. Michael Urban is the senior lecturer and director, the Doctorate of Occupational Therapy Program at the University of New Haven. Great stuff. Dr. Urban, thank you. We appreciate it. And hopefully we'll talk down the road. Stay safe. Have a good holiday season and be good.
You too. Thank you very much. Have a good holiday. Thank you.
Thanks, Doctor. Dr. Michael Urban, Senior Lecturer, Director, and of the Doctorate of Occupational Therapy Program at the University of New Haven.
Let's go to the COVID Daily Summary, if we could. What you see here is 3 days worth of numbers. I think a couple of things strike me. One, 4.8% positivity. That's a little less than we were used to last week. Don't jump to any conclusions, but our average positivity has gone on a weekly basis from 5.8 to 5.5. I think you are going to see it bouncing around. I do worry that the upward trend could continue. Hospitalizations, 27. We had 60 in a three-day period last week, but let's watch those numbers carefully as well. I think you know why. Fatalities, 43. 3 million tests. We have now done 3 million tests. It took us 5 months to do the first 1 million tests. It took us 1 month to do the last million tests. And that means we're doing everything we can to get ahead of this virus, test those most at risk, go to our nursing homes, first responders, and each and every one of you on a broad base so we can figure out how we stay ahead of what's going on here. And that's why I think the testing is very important. We'll talk about that in a minute. Next up is Step Up Connecticut. Step Up Connecticut reflects the fact that last time when we got hit, which was in that spring period, we were worried about material shortages. We were worried about masks and gowns. We were worried about hospital beds. We were worried about lab capacity so we'd able to do more testing. I think now here we are some months later. We've got the masks and gowns and PPE and stockpiled. Our hospitals are in pretty good shape there. We know we have the ability to expand bed capacity. When it comes to testing, you've seen that we're now at over 200,000 tests every week and able to ramp that up. with one severe caveat, which I want to talk about, and that's people. So what Step Up Connecticut is an opportunity for you to go to ct.gov, Step Up Connecticut, and step up, because we could use your help. Look, we have we're sending all of the colleges home, something we had anticipated. That means there will be a lot of college-age students. Look, you can binge-watch Netflix for 3 weeks, but we have some other ways you can really be of assistance helping your entire community get through this pandemic. One, when it comes to hospitals and the fact we allot doctors and nurses, many working a double shift, get some exhaustion, any healthcare experience at all, please go to Step Up Connecticut and see if you can step in and help us out in a whole variety of different ways, depending on your skill level. Same question when it comes to supporting our testing sites. As you know, people are waiting in lines, and those lines reflect the fact that more and more people want to get tested. We have the lab capacity, but we are trying to expand our capacity for people to take the swabs and expand the lines we have there as best we can. And the way we do that is with more people. We need you there. You can help administratively. You can help with the swabs, help manage what's going on there. Go to Step Up Connecticut. We could use your help. And finally, it's our schools. And as you know, when it comes to our schools, right now we're finding that if schools have to close, the reason generally isn't due to a high positivity in the classroom. In fact, the positivity rate tends to be lowest in the classroom, but it does seem to reflect the fact that sometimes staff have to quarantine. You have teachers who are older, teachers with a pre-existing condition, and those are the places where we need people to step in. So again, if you go to Step Up Connecticut, what you can do there is find if you have a teaching or social work or a general love of kids as a senior in college, we may be able to find you paid work at some of our schools. Look, it'll be an experienced teacher who's perhaps quarantining, zooming into the classroom, and you can help out in the classroom. Social, emotional, tutorial, and keeping an eye on the kids themselves who are there. Those are just three ways that you can help out Step Up Connecticut, volunteer as well as paid jobs. Look forward to seeing some action on that site pretty soon. Let's go to the next one, Max. As we come up to the Thanksgiving Day on Thursday, I thought this was sort of interesting. We did an analysis. If we said, look, if you have no more than 10 people at your table, and they're not all people you know. These are not necessarily from your immediate family. Maybe it's a friend of a friend. If it's a random group in Fairfield County, you've got a 24% chance that one of those people is infected. New London County, it's only 14%, but don't get overconfident there either. I don't say this to scare you. I say this so you understand why we've had a limit of 10. I say this to remind you why it's so important you keep your particular cohort, your immediate family, this Thanksgiving. That'll mean you have a much better chance for Christmas and Thanksgiving next year than safe. And by the way, if it's 20 people around that table, you can take these numbers and almost double them. You can see why we're trying to be so cautious when it comes to the Thanksgiving holidays coming up. This next picture is just a odd one, but I was amused by the fact that small turkeys are selling like hotcakes, I guess was the old phrase. With smaller groups, 4, 6, 10 around the table, we don't need the big turkeys, so you're going to find that smaller turkeys are what's selling right now. Maybe a trend for the future. And finally, I just wanted to showcase this headline from the New York Times before getting Suzanne Lagarde on. This just reminds us that, look, you're all getting tested. Folks coming back from college are getting tested. And a negative coronavirus test doesn't mean, yippee, I'm home free. Far from it. We strongly tell you, you got to continue to wear the mask, especially if you can't social distance. Do both if you can. I know this is tough. I know we got to do this for another couple of months, but it'll make a world of difference. With that, Suzanne Lagarde has done amazing work at the Fairhaven Community Center doing yeoman's work in getting more people tested. And she has an amusing story about some folks who stepped up to help make that wait a little more pleasant. Suzanne?
Thank you so much, Governor. I just want to tell your viewers how grateful we are to you and the state for supporting our testing efforts. Ever since the spring, we've been testing out in the community with support through the state with CARES dollars, testing high-risk, vulnerable communities. That's the population we serve here at Fairhaven, and I am truly very grateful to you for that opportunity to be able to serve our community. To your point about workforce, I can't stress enough how we're sort of bending under the weight of the demand for testing. The summer was very manageable. We were, you know, we manned a COVID testing line, two full-time people. We asked people to call so we could pre-register them. We were averaging 80, 90 calls a day, and that was very manageable. In the past 3 to 4 weeks, we have seen that number more than quadruple. We have welcomed walk-ins, but with that, we're having lines that literally go around the block. And the interesting story that you referred to happened yesterday, Sunday. We recognized the need to test in the weekends for those people who couldn't make it during the workday. So we held a test event yesterday at our local school in the outside at the Columbus Academy here in Fairhaven. And we knew that it was going to be cold. It was going to be raw. The forecast was not great. So the one thing we wanted so badly to avoid was having long lines for hours upon hours. So when we got there around 8 a.m. for a 9 o'clock start, there were well over 100 people already in line, but we came prepared with literally 20 people for that one testing event. We had 4 people signing up of patients, 4 people swabbing, but then we had people working the line, giving them phone numbers to call. We had people inside taking those calls to register them so that when they got to the front desk, all they had to do was sign in. We managed to get through that line in about an hour, such that by the time 10 o'clock rolled around, we were testing. Nobody was waiting more than 15 minutes. We continued to test consistently through that 3-hour period. In 3 hours, we tested over 330 patients, but nobody had to stand in line for very long. And we were so grateful to be able to do that, but it literally took a village, as they say. We had 20 people there with IT, facilities, runners, and all the swabbers and those at the front desk. And we recognized that there was going to, you know, it's pretty dreary standing in line waiting to get a COVID test. So I have to give credit to my staff. It was my staff's idea, but we brought in a mariachi band to play during the testing. And I was there myself the entire time, and it definitely lifted the spirits. And it was a little bright spot in an otherwise dreary day in a time that's, you know, difficult for so many people. So my message, Governor, is that so many people in this state, all health centers for sure and others, are doing our best to test as much as we can. We need more workforce, as you just mentioned. We are the place where we need the most help are people with that registration. We need to get them trained fairly quickly on our EMR. We're on Epic, but the same is true for people with other types of EMRs. That's the bottleneck right now. And we're grateful we're getting some of your National Guardsmen next week. So that's going to help for sure. And that's our story. We're doing our best. We're also testing in 8 nursing homes as part of your Care Partners program, where all nursing homes are getting tested on a weekly basis. It's a lot of work, but I think everybody recognizes the importance of it.
Thank you very, very much, Suzanne. And if any of you play an instrument, you want to do some performance and cheer up some people waiting in line, I think Suzanne's story reminds you of that. Hey, Miguel, give us just a little insight into what's going on with schools as we get ready for the Thanksgiving break.
Dr. Miguel Cardona, the state's education commissioner.
Yes, I'm really pleased to share that due to the great planning in the summer months and the fall months, we were able to provide in-person learning opportunities for roughly 350,000 students. And I just want to thank all the educators, the parents for their flexibility, and for your commitment to making it happen. We know that there's no replacement for in-person learning, and those efforts will continue. But we've been able to give in-person learning opportunities for over 350,000 Connecticut students, which is about 70% of our students who opted for that option. And we're pleased with that. And because of those efforts, our students have had more opportunities for in-person learning in Connecticut than some of our surrounding states. So I just wanted to say that, you know, in the week of Thanksgiving, that's something that we're really thankful for, the opportunity that our students got in Connecticut.
Well, thank you for giving them that opportunity. All right, Max, Josh and Paul, Suzanne, Miguel, we're ready.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, everyone. Regarding the Safe Schools, Successful Schools Now report that came out with teachers unions, they're saying that Connecticut must move all schools to remote learning or create and enforce statewide protections for any in-class education, saying that to date there has not been adequate testing of students and staff to determine spread and scope of infections within schools. Wanting to get whether Governor, maybe your reaction, the commissioner, to that, as well as what the threshold is, if you have one, to go remote only for all schools.
I think our schools have done an extraordinary job putting up public health and safety first. Melissa McCall, you know, way back early in the summer said, tell us everything you're going to need to keep your kids safe. And that included a mask and worked on ventilation, worked on disinfectant, what we had to do there. Josh has put testing preeminently up front and made sure that any teacher or student want to get tested, they'd be able to get tested. I can't mandate that, by the way. Right now, Miguel is going to all the schools, are bringing Binax testing. Binax is, we got 50, 75,000 a week. We can get those to the schools. A lot of them were in the colleges before. That gives you an immediate 15-minute response, tells you whether you're tested positive or negative. And that's also part of why we're getting, you know, the young people there as well. If we can get those apprentice teachers in there, if you're an older teacher that doesn't feel safe, an older teacher that feels like you ought to be quarantining, we can get somebody younger in to complement your teaching from remote. So we're doing everything we can to give these kids the best shot as long as we can do it safely.
Thank you, Governor. And I would echo those comments. I think you laid it out nicely. But, you know, I think the key thing to remember is health and safety is still going to be the primary indicator of whether or not schools should be open. As you know, we made the decision to provide guidelines and allow local health directors and superintendents to be looking at the local factors, which determine whether or not those schools should be open. And decisions have been made based on the local factors around when to close schools. So I don't know that one universal number is the best way to approach it. In some cases, the community spread is greater than in other cases. So we need to let the experts at the ground level that have the experience looking at what's happening in their communities make the ultimate decision.